From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. From economics to the woke agenda, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right. Breaking news today. We have a new lawsuit filed by my organization, Committee for Constructive Tomorrow, with whom Climate Depot, my website, is a project of. So I'm involved. We're also involved with the National Legal Policy Center in this lawsuit and the Heartland Institute. Who are we suing and what are we doing? We are suing the Biden administration. And we are suing them over the failure of the Biden administration for issuing offshore wind permits to allow for the killing of whales and threatening endangered species like the right whale. The Endangered Species Act is not being followed. Conservatives, libertarians, you can imagine this is upsetting. First, I'll tell you who it's upsetting, but let's actually get to what we're doing. Coalition sues to block Virginia offshore wind project to protect the right whale. This is on CFAC.org, also Climate Depot. A lawsuit filed by the Heartland Institute, Committee for Constructive Tomorrow, CFAC, and the National Legal Policy Center. Construction of Virginia's Dominion Energy offshore wind project comes as more and more dead whales are washing up in the Atlantic coast. The North Atlantic right whale is so critically endangered that the federal agency says it cannot endure not even one human-caused death a year. Now, keep in mind, I've interviewed guests on this program on TNT that say that the federal government allows the taking during the construction of this offshore wind more whales than are known to exist in species like the right whale and other endangered whale species. In other words, they're allowed to incidentally, not necessarily go out and harpoon them and kill them for pleasure, but during the construction of this, if a certain number of whales die, the number they were allotted is it exceeds the known number in the wild for some of these endangered whales. This is filed in U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. I touched on this yesterday. Reuters News, big headline, right-wing groups sue U.S. over offshore wind impact on whales. So I decided to get involved. I'm going to show you guys the exclusive video never before aired on TNT of me the Committee for Constructive Tomorrow, CFAC, as well as liberal activists that were out there at the time, transgender rights. I talked about this on my audio-only program last year before we moved into the video age. It would be kind of like that was the radio era. Now we're in the golden age of television in this evolution. So Reuters says that three right-wing groups sued the Biden administration over its approval of wind project off the coast of Virginia, alleging it failed to consider the windmill's impact on endangered whales. The lawsuit filed by the three groups seeks to stop the construction of the offshore wind in coastal Virginia, the offshore wind pending to a new federal analysis of risks to the North Atlantic right whale. Let me say this simply. This is conservatives, libertarians, anti-regulatory people using the Federal Endangered Species Act to stop the coveted, the religious-like fervor momentum of green energy. We're going right at the heart of the whales, of the offshore wind to protect the whales. And this has been picked up now in the Hill, environmental groups. This was funny because the Sierra Club and Prospect Magazine did a joint report leading with yours truly, the host of this program, as the whale activists. And here's how they started their article. This is just came out last week, March 12, 2024. Last July, 2023, a small group of rabble-rousers boarded a trio of powerboats, banners, and bullhorns in hand. And by the way, it was a Radio Shack realistic model megaphone from the 1980s that I was using. They were headed for the massive floating construction site of an offshore wind farm 35 miles off the eastern tip of Long Island and also about the same off of Martha's Vineyard. As the boats motored through the swells, the self-styled activists broke into a chorus of pleas for the wind farm construction to cease. Chants likely intended less for the still faraway workers than for the camera there to capture. Hear this message. We're here to save the whales, called out a man in a black polo shirt. If you were a fossil fuel project, you would have been shut down long ago. The apparent conservation activist was, in fact, infamous climate change disinformation artist Mark Morano, who's done more than perhaps any other person to manufacture doubt about global warming. From his perch at Climate Depot, the blog he's run since 2009, Morano has elevated fake climate experts, encouraged the harassment of real climate scientists, and promoted the myth of global cooling, unquote. That is the big report that came out. And now this is all going to be used in the lawsuit. They're trying to smear me here. First of all, I don't elevate fake experts. I interview, and I've interviewed on this program. You've seen the exclusive interview with the Nobel Prize winning scientist in physics, not the fake Nobelist, Michael Mann, who didn't even win the Nobel Peace Prize, but claims he did. And that Peace Prize was a political prize. I interviewed the Nobel Prize winner in physics, Dr. John Clauser. And those are the kind of voices I elevate. Dr. Will Happer, foremost expert on greenhouse gases. Dr. Richard Lindzen, who I've had on TNT, MIT climate scientist, led the whole division. Dr. Judith Curry, who was just on, I believe, the end of January of this year, head of the atmospheric physics department at Georgia Tech University, not MIT. And so it's silly. And the harassment is because back during ClimateGate, I posted emails, publicly available emails of their work emails at universities of the scientists involved in the massive deception of global warming. And of course, they got hate mail and they heard from the public probably for the first time in their lives. These are closeted researchers getting grant money, going to UN climate summits, completely in an insulated bubble. Stand by that. Happy I did it. And I'm going to show you this footage here in a minute, but I just wanted to say that this is going to be a growing story. They can't ignore this. This is why wire services like Reuters are picking it up. The environmentalists are picking it up. This is going to go the shot heard around the world. And what we're hoping, like you're seeing the farmers' rebellion in Europe with the tractors at the gates of hell or the gates of the EU, I should say, spraying manure. And the same way we saw the truckers in Canada with the protests against the vaccine mandates and mask mandates and social distancing, and the same way we're seeing the collapse of EVs, we want to go after the heart of wind power, which doesn't produce energy, about 3% of U.S. energy. It's still it's an old, outdated technology. And again, there could be some technological advancement someday, so I don't want to bash it. But the idea that they're mandating these virtue signaling little things out in the water that's hurting the whales and sonar. And we've had guests. As we continue with this story, I will continue to have guests on and we'll get into the science behind of the whales and everything else. So let's go ahead and play. This will be clip one. This is our whale protest, which spurred this whole thing. And we're hoping this snowballs into a huge rebellion. This is going to hopefully give the mayors, governors, town councils, boards of supervisors along the coast for these monstrosities that don't produce energy and harm whales the idea and the momentum to start fighting back and a legal strategy by which to do so. And we may even win this thing. Clip one. This is our protest last July, 2023, off the coast of Martha's Vineyard in Long Island. It was in Newport, Rhode Island. So let's play this. This is our protest, me and a bunch of other activists, including a lot of liberals. Clip one, along with CFAX's Craig Rucker. Roll tape.
Roger.
What do you think that thing is on the right?
Fisheries has given out over 700,000 takes for marine mammals. This is ludicrous. You are, liberals are, trying to what? Kill the planet to save it? It makes no sense. This is insanity. Please stop.
Forrestad, you hear that? Stop pile driving now! You guys, it's inexcusable! Your wind power, it's a joke! There's only 350 right whales left! And your operations here are putting them in harm! Stop it today! Stop wind! Save whales! Stop wind!
Save whales! Stop wind! Save whales! Stop wind! Save whales!
Worsted! Hear this message. We are here to save the whales. If you were a fossil fuel project, you would have been shut down long ago, as the mortality of whales piling up on East Coast beaches would have shut you down. For some reason, you are politically protected. Windmills offshore are protected for some reason by the politics of our country. Well, no more.
Stop windmills. Save the whales. Stop.
And yes, that protest actually included three boats in total. We had to go out. It was about a 90-minute or hour, 40-minute straight shot in a little, I don't want to call it a tugboat, but it was a small boat, and we had about 22 on each boat stuffed in there. Very choppy waters. It wasn't too choppy. I thought I was going to go. Should I bring seasickness pills? I was fine. I actually drank a beer and smoked a cigar on the way back from the protest. I didn't do it on the way there. But we had a couple people in that choppy water, small boat. It was way out there. But we delivered that message. That made it, I believe, the front page of the New York Post. The video made it out on the New York Post. And that laid the groundwork. We worked with these different coalitions and groups to now file this lawsuit, which I'm part of, to save the whales from offshore wind using the Federal Endangered Species Act. So let's see. I will keep you posted. One of the fun statements, I'm having some fun with this, I issued. I'm having some fun tweaking is what I should be saying. This is my official release. I've never asked repeatedly. I have asked repeatedly, where are the 1970s Volvo driving, save the whale liberals when you need them? The answer is they appear to have gone AWOL. So it's up to conservatives to become the legal champion to save the whales. And this is where we are right now in 2024. The liberals, the environmentalists, who you would think would be championing a species like whales, that they cut their bread and butter, Greenpeace in the 1970s, going after whaling ships in the North Pacific for Iceland and Japan, and are now all silent because green energy trumps whales. And that's, it's just that simple. Okay, moving, and we'll be having, I'm gonna have guests and we'll be continuing this story. It's gonna be unfolding. This is a mainstream media breaking news story, picked up by U.S. wire services, U.S. publications, and we are going to be attacked by Biden administration officials. We are going after the Biden administration in federal court. We'll see you in court. Okay. Now, there's a new documentary, Epic TV, coming out about the Green New Deal, about the UN, about net zero, about sustainable development. They got some big figure in it. Let's take a look. I'm not sure who this is. This is clip two, Epic Times TV on net zero climate agenda. The Green New Deal really is just the latest incarnation of that impulse that, you know, humans can't be free because we will destroy everything. And it's, we need expert management of them. So, and where we stand currently, the Green New Deal was pushed, actually implemented in Europe. They're many years ahead of us. And we can see how where the United States is heading by looking at Europe. We can see where Boris Johnson's administration bragged about pouring cement into the fracking wells as a net zero in 2019, I believe, as a net zero virtue signal. We can see Germany and France and the Nordic all giving up their domestic energy to rely more and more energy from Russia. And that's, you can see where it's caused a national security thing. But that was all because of their adherence to the Green New Deal, much stricter than the U.S. So now the United States, of course, is following that path.
And if you thought that was interesting, well, hit that subscribe button and get more videos just like this.
I know. Who was that? That was me. I didn't know they were going to have it. I thought it was going to be someone else. All right. That's the new Epic Times. You can go to Epic TV to take a look, and that should be premiering later this week. And that's going to be they sat down with me for about an hour in my Washington, D.C. office. Okay. Along the same veins of that, Yuval Noah Harari, the World Economic Forum's agenda contributor, has some new news about how the 21st century, he's telling you what it's going to be about. It's going to be about your personal struggle against irrelevance, because you are a useless eater and you're a useless class. You're a person who doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. This is Yuval Noah Harari, clip 3. Let's take a listen and a look.
In Davos, we hear so much about the enormous promises of technology. And these promises are certainly real, but technology might also disrupt human society and the very meaning of human life in numerous ways, ranging from the creation of a global useless class to the rise of data colonialism and of digital dictatorships. First, we might face upheavals on the social and economic level. Automation will soon eliminate millions upon millions of jobs. And while new jobs will certainly be created, it is unclear whether people will be able to learn the necessary new skills fast enough. Suppose you are a 50-year-old truck driver and you just lost your job to a self-driving vehicle. Now, there are new jobs in designing software or in teaching yoga to engineers. But how does a 50-year-old truck driver reinvent himself or herself as a software engineer or as a yoga teacher? And people will have to do it not just once, but again and again throughout their lives.
Well, first of all, on one level, he's talking about the existence of human beings, human history. You know, what happened to the whaling ships when fossil fuels came along? Fossil fuels saved the whales at the end of the 19th century or middle of the 19th century. They no longer needed whale oil to power the lamps so we could start, you know, burning coal and other forms of fossil fuel. Every time a new technology, the horse and carriage buggy industry went, you know, significant rollbacks when the Henry Ford and the automobile came upon the scene. The radio industry faced, you know, I'm talking about radio fictionalized series, faced many adjustments when television came on the line. So you always have these adjustments. What's scary is allowing a global elitist organization like World Economic Forum to come in and plan. This is Yuval Noah Harari, part 2 on what he'd like to have see happen in the 21st century against irrelevance.
Those who fail in the struggle against irrelevance would constitute a new useless class. People who are useless, not from the viewpoint of their friends and family, of course, but useless from the viewpoint of the economic and political system. And this useless class will be separated by an ever-growing gap from the ever more powerful elite.
And there he is talking now. It's an interesting style that he has. And it's similar to what Paul Ehrlich did all those years ago, where they believe a certain thing and it's dripping out of every pore. But they know they have to adjust it. So they present themselves as an analyst. And other interviews he's given, he's very clear that he considers people useless eaters and he wants to give you psychotropic drugs and video games to occupy your mind for these useless class. Here he's sort of saying it as an analyst, like, well, these forces are happening. And yet the driving force behind this of the crushing the middle class, impoverishing the poor and empowering the elites from everything from COVID lockdowns to the regulatory state to the administrative state, where no one can afford any of these costs for startup, for businesses, for economics, for making money, unless you're this massive billionaire class who can afford it. Remember, we had California Governor Gavin Newsom bragged that California was doing great. It had more, the creation of more billionaires than any other state, as that widening gap. And then at the people at the bottom, They want to give you universal basic income. And you're the useless class. Well, though, you're not that useless at the bottom, if you're like that, because you're useful to them only because you're a voting block and because you're easy to control if you're on their payroll, so to speak. It's the middle class. It's the working class, blue-collar workers. They're the ones they fear the most. It's small mom-and-pop industries. This is why New York City is crushing the pizzerias even further. When I say they're crushing it, it's not like the mayor in New York wants to just help billionaires, at least directly or even that they're aware of it. These are the policies being pushed to make us all a useless class unless you're in that global elite. And even Naval Yohari appeals that, links to that or alludes to that. Okay, we got to take a break. When we come back, Rick Ahlstrom, a retired police chief of 34 years, he's worked on law enforcement. He also served in the National Guard. He is going to be speaking about what's going on in America, from immigration, crime, defund the police, our cities. How did America get this way? Is this all a plot to turn us into a more fascist state, because you're going to need federalizing all of our cities because local police can't handle it? We'll have Rick Ahlstrom on when we return on Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned.
TNT's James Freeman.
Now that I'm sitting on the other side of the fence, I see the budget in a very different light. I find the discussions and leaks in the press in the weeks running up to the budget totally patronising. You know, will he, won't he, give us some tax cuts? When the reality is that nothing in the budget will make any material difference to anyone, pretty much. That's usually the story. It is a game of musical chairs where the government giveth with one hand and taketh with the other. And we're all reminded about how little money that we've got left in our pockets.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT.
JDRF's vision is to create a world without type 1 diabetes. The type 1 diabetes community is at the heart of everything JDRF does. We were founded by the type 1 diabetes community. In the main, we are governed by the type 1 diabetes community, we're energised by the type 1 community, and we're accountable to the type 1 diabetes community. It's on their behalf that we exist, and it's on their behalf that we must succeed. JDRF exists to rid the world of type 1 diabetes. It's easy to say, but it's hard to do. So for us, that means rallying all the resources and all the people and all the organisations required to make that a reality as quickly as possible. The world's best researchers, exciting innovative companies, and the passion of the type 1 diabetes community, then delivered through the health system so lives get better every day, day after day, until the day we find a cure. To everybody in the type 1 diabetes community, no matter your age or stage with the disease, whether you were diagnosed recently or a long time ago, we need you to know that we are here working on your behalf to deliver a world without type 1 diabetes as quickly as we can. Thank you to everybody who's supported JDRF in so many ways. You are making our vision of a world without type 1 diabetes possible.
If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining us now on the program is Rick Ahlstrom, retired police chief of 34 years, working in law enforcement. He served the National Guard for 8 years. He speaks out on law enforcement, immigration, and we're going to be discussing a whole host of issues today. Welcome to the program, Rick.
Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate the invitation.
All right. Now tell us, you were a retired police chief. Tell us a little bit about your career, background, your time in the National Guard, and what your experience was with policing when you were an active police chief.
I was in law enforcement from 1974 until my retirement in 2008. We were in a Midwest community of about 40,000, a university community. And so we dealt with not only college students, but we dealt with a variety of people, and we faced different challenges with them, particularly when I became police chief with hiring. It was very difficult in the early 2000s to even hire then, because of the baby boomers were leaving faster than we could replace them.
Wow. So what made you, did you just retire because you were ready to retire, or did something fundamentally change? Give us an example of how law enforcement evolved from 1974 to 2008 in your community.
Well, the equipment changed dramatically. We didn't wear protective vests, bulletproof vests when I started. That came later. The weapons that we carried were upgraded later. The introduction of computer systems, not only in the station, but in the cars, was upgraded. And video conferencing, became a standard where when I started, it was, simply unheard of, or science fiction, if you will.
Yeah. Video. So how did you see today, like you go to any major city, San Francisco, L.A., New York, you'll see homeless encampments, you'll see drug areas where they just sort of write it off. You'll see tent cities, you'll see defecation, urination. I don't know if your community ever had to deal with that, but how has that evolved in policing? It seems like that used to be broken up. If you watch like the old Andy Griffith show, just to give you an example, that was a small town in fictional Mayberry, North Carolina town, but they would always arrest the town drunk just for being drunk in public. We've come a long way since that. They seem to now designate their own, sectors of the entire cities, or actually the cities have been overrun with that. What did you ever have to deal with that? And where did that come from? The idea that these cities, they were just going to allow the embedding, permanent embedding of homeless, of drug addicts, of defecation, urination in the streets and tent cities.
We didn't deal so much with homeless as we dealt with mentally ill that were unable to remain in some type of lodging. We didn't have the tent cities. To me, they're the antithesis of community policing, because you have your citizens that are afraid to walk through that area or unable to walk through that area, or they don't even have full use of their property. And community policing would have been, okay, we have a problem here. We need to deal with this problem. And letting it fester and grow is not dealing with the problem. It's, in fact, it's encouraging the problem to continue.
Well, looking at like a continuum of, say, major U.S. cities, they seem to go in swings, particularly like I'm more familiar with Washington, D.C. and New York City. If you look at it, you'd say the 50s were safer, 60s, it started getting very unsafe, 70s were, I would say, a disaster. In places like New York, 80s weren't much better until later on, maybe early 90s, when people like Mayor Giuliani came in. One of the first things he did was stop the squeegee workers, from the people that came up to your car, usually homeless, trying to get money, uninitiated, they'd start cleaning your windshield. He also stopped graffiti based on sort of the broken window concept. The idea is you don't allow any graffiti, any small crimes. If you take care of that, the rest will be. And so New York City actually transformed for the longest period, for a decade plus. It was a wonderful city to go visit because they allowed the police to essentially police. And then, of course, things went back. So first question is, what causes that sort of ebb and flow? Do you agree with that? The cities going back, say, 50, 70 years, the ebb and flow of safer cities versus chaotic, high crime, and then back to safer. We seem to be in a very unsafe, probably the most unsafe right now of our major cities. What causes those cycles? How do we smooth that out? And what is your assessment of sort of the national cities in these cycles of safety? And then they sort of revamp to criminals running free.
Well, first of all, broken windows theory of policing works. We practiced it. I read the book by the person that came up with it, and it works. And you mentioned the squeegee men.
Yes.
The transit cops in New York used to enforce the turnstile jumpers and the people that would enter through the exit doors. Well, there was a shooting last week in New York City where the person who brought the gun to the shooting and started the fight and ended up getting shot, entered through an exit door. Well, in the Rudy Giuliani days of community policing, broken windows policing, that probably would not have occurred. And so that incident would not have occurred. The squeegee men, again, would not have occurred. And so I think what you have is, and it really, I think the defund the police movement really was a huge setback, not only to the cities or to the police departments, but to the cities. I'll use New York again as an example where they defunded it, but they also took away the qualified immunity for the police officer so that they could personally be sued for any enforcement action they took. And, you know, which is, I never had to worry about that. I always wanted to do things right. But I also knew that the city would defend me if I was sued. And that's gone for them. So it's really taken an incentive away for effective law enforcement when you could lose your home as a police officer simply for writing a ticket to the wrong person.
Wow. Yeah, that's one aspect I didn't think of. Is that in other cities? Are you aware of that? Is that true in L.A., San Francisco, Philadelphia, Chicago? I mean, you can sue policemen. This is all because of George Floyd, I would assume, right? It's just a way to the activists had the laws changed. But that's pretty damaging because then, you know, what's the incentive for a policeman to do his job if he could potentially lose his home, lose his all his possessions, correct?
That's correct. And New York is the only one, a major city that I know of that took that step. The rest of them cut budgets, cut recruiting, but they took that additional, really penalizing step. And it's an anti-police step. And you couple that with their New York's no bail law, which also I think California has something similar, or at least Los Angeles does. You know, so you arrest somebody for armed robbery and they're out before you've even started your paperwork simply because they don't meet that bail requirement and they're out to perpetrate again. And so really it's a death spiral of a city that needs to be reversed if the city is going to survive long term.
Wow. So if you look at, you know, again, New York City under Giuliani, he was called a fascist. And, you know, because of the way he allowed the police to police and the broken window thing we talked about, where every minor transgression was stopped on the theory that it would stop major transgressions. Just tell me, like, the opposition. I mean, you obviously discussed, talked, you faced face to face, you've arrested people. How do they justify this? Do people just think the police, they don't like the idea of an orderly city that's safe, or they really think the police are an arm of a fascist state that's out to just destroy people and target minorities? What's the thinking that goes into reversing and making these laws like defund the police and getting rid of that, the liability that a policeman has, or giving the policeman no liability? What's the ideology? How do you understand it?
Well, part of it is the George Floyd reaction. That was a horrendous event, and the politicians reacted to it. I think way overreacted to it. But the opposition to policing is they view it as a free society, live and let live. If you want to do drugs or whatever, you should be able to do that. And you see that with the actions of people. And so you try and come to a middle ground with them. But to me, the law is the law. If you don't like the law, then you change the law. You don't ignore the law. And so it really was a clash of a free spirit, live and let live. If I want to camp on somebody's sidewalk, I should be able to camp on their sidewalk. And they don't recognize that as being a disorderly event, or that would be fearful for somebody that comes out of their house. If you're 68, 70 years old and there's somebody camped on your sidewalk, you don't know who they are or what they're doing. And so that, you know, that has added to the problem. And then the the hatefulness of the police conduct or the alleged police conduct that occurred, and the reaction by the politicians who were in a position to do something about it. But it's been going on for a while.
I went to San Jose, California, 2019. Seemed like a pretty normal, didn't notice anything out of the ordinary when it came to law enforcement or crime. I went back in 2022 after the whole defund the police movement, and the same places, same hotels. The hotels had to add, you know, barrier gates with barbed wire that you had to go to a guardhouse and they'd open the gate. These are just hotels randomly throughout the city, right on the edge of the city. And the nicest restaurants, nicest strip malls with like expensive stores, meaning higher end stores, would have signs up, don't leave any valuables in your car. And everyone there was telling me, oh yeah, everything's changed. You know, I leave my trunk open. I leave the car unlocked. I roll the windows down because there's no reason. I don't want someone to pry open my trunk, because what they did in the key case of San Jose, California, was they changed the rules so that everything was a misdemeanor. So they couldn't prosecute anyone, even if you broke in a car, stole anything out, shoplifting, et cetera. How did, just go a little bit on those laws. I mean, that's along the same vein of everything we've been talking about, but it just seemed like it allowed complete lawlessness where people didn't even want to park in a high-end store and leave your car there because it was almost guaranteed to be broken into. And you couldn't even go into a hotel without having to call a guardhouse and, you know, be cleared in and gates open and close after you, which kind of reminds you of a military state. How do people accept this? And how does that happen? And tell us a little bit about the misdemeanor, how everything's now a misdemeanor, what used to be considered a felony.
Well, in California, they changed the theft laws. And I think that you can't arrest unless there's a $900 value of theft. And so, you know, people aren't stupid. They're going into the stores and stealing $899 worth of stuff each, or roughly. And they're walking out and it's in broad daylight. Well, a store, they simply can't continue to support that. And so you're seeing, particularly in San Francisco now, major retailers are closing. They can't afford to stay open. You're seeing hotels close. You're seeing now businesses or business parks, the high rises that are sitting empty. In fact, one of the largest landowners in San Francisco is just going to go bankrupt because the city is not going to allow its people to stay in that high rise because of the atmosphere of it. I spent a week in San Francisco in 2018, and we were down by the wharf. And the police officers, the police department did a very good job of around Fisherman's Wharf of keeping the homeless away from the tourists, really the tourist area. But you walk a block outside of that area, you couldn't walk on the sidewalk. It was completely covered. And that just as the politicians have changed, they've allowed that to encroach now to where they've literally have driven businesses, particularly in San Francisco and Oakland, where they've just driven them to close and go elsewhere.
But how long can this continue? Like, there was an article recently about how major, like you mentioned, major chains, business conferences, everyone's just done with the city of San Francisco. No one wants to go there. It's a human cesspool of crime, drugs, homeless, fecal matter in the streets, stores closing, bankruptcy, abandoned blocks. How does a city, how does a mayor, and I think her name's London Breed, she's actually come out and given a lot of speeches about how we're going to change this and we're going to give the police more, but I don't think anything's happened. Do you think this is going to continue indefinitely, or is this going to go through some major change? What's your sense, talking to other police officers, talking to the public? How long is the appetite for people in these cities to live this way going to continue?
I don't think there's an appetite for it to continue. I think the problem is that they've got to vote out the politicians, the council people, or whatever. They've got to vote them out and bring in people that literally are going to clean up the city or represent the citizens. the voting citizens, the working citizens, the business owners. And I would guess for San Francisco, you're looking at probably another 4 years before you're going to get a majority, because they have staggered elections. And so, you know, you may get two elected this time, but they're still in the minority. Next go around in 2 years, maybe you get another one or two or whatever. But it's going to take that long to change it. It didn't get messed up in one day, and you're not going to fix it in one day. And my theory, when I was a police chief, I always said, if it took 10 years to have it messed up, it's going to take us 10 years to fix it, you know, to overcome that. And I think San Francisco is in, I don't think they've hit bottom yet. I think they're starting to feel the pressure. I think when they start seeing the decrease in tax revenue, the city does, from property taxes, then when they start having to defund police departments because they don't have the funding, or close hospitals, count or city hospitals, or close fire stations, at that point, you know, then they're coming close to the bottom, but they're not there yet. Oakland is closer to the bottom than San Francisco.
Well, you mentioned that, but in the case of San Francisco, do you really think, and this is what I was sort of getting, what's their ideology, do you really think the residents of San Francisco, who, for lack of a better word, are probably one of the most woke in the country, the voters, that they're going to start voting for reformers? They would have to change their whole worldview in order to do that. I guess what I'm ultimately asking you, are there people who promoted defund the police and voted for it? Are they happy with San Francisco? You're saying they might be to a certain extent, but once it affects their revenue, they'll start. It's just, it would be hard to believe they would vote themselves out, but I don't know. But yeah, I'm just saying, yeah. So you actually think that they would actually change their ideology in order to vote for people to change that, the crime situation?
I do, and I'll tell you why. Because Ronald Reagan at one time was a liberal Democrat. And if Ronald Reagan, who I think was one of the greatest presidents of the United States, can start as a liberal Democrat and become a conservative Republican, anybody can change. And I think when crime affects them or their businesses are closed, it's going to force change. They may not like it, but it's going to force them to realize that what we're doing isn't working, and continuing to do it is the definition of insanity. It just simply is not going.
All right, we're talking with Rick Ahlstrom, a retired police chief, 34 years experience. We're talking about crime in U.S. cities, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk about illegal immigration. We're going to talk about whether a lot of this chaos in the cities is setting us up for the federalization of police forces. If communities can't do it, is this a justification to bring in the government? I think New York City's bringing in National Guard troops now. We'll be right back. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands, heal our waters, and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. But every day we lose more of the places we love, and we urgently need to save endangered lands, waters, and wild species. The actions we take today will determine the tomorrow we leave to our children and grandchildren. The water they drink, the air they breathe, the beauty they experience. To learn more about how you can help protect and conserve our beautiful world, visit nature.org today.
Asthma is a growing problem, especially among children. Asthma affects the quality of life for millions like me every single day. My name is Chris Draft, and I have asthma. And I've spent more than a decade in the NFL tackling asthma on and off the field. Join me in the EPA in helping people control their asthma. Asthma is a lung condition that can be controlled through medication and by avoiding things that can make it worse. Three steps are the solution to controlling asthma. Step one, talk to a doctor. Step two, make a plan. And step 3, get rid of things that can make it worse. Asthma can be tackled. For more information on asthma, log on to epa.gov/asthma.
Mark Morano is unleashed, and he's taking on the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed on TNT. I'm your host, Mark Morano. All right, we're continuing our discussion with Rick Ahlstrom, retired police chief of 34 years. Is this the worst you've ever seen America's cities in your lifetime? In other words, was New York City worse in the 1970s than it is today? Was LA or San Francisco worse in the 70s and 80s? I remember there was a movie, Fort Apache, the Bronx, and that was either in early 80s or 1980. They showed like a dystopian Mad Max hellscape for New York City. Was it worse back then? Are we following the era of, oh, this is the worst because it's our time and we're alive now and we're witnessing it? Or have we forgotten how bad they used to be? So how would you evaluate that historically?
Back then was not pleasant. Fort Apache, the Bronx was one of my favorite movies, as a cop. What we see now are different factors. What you're seeing now is more of a political, a drive to some of this with the illegal immigration, coming in and frankly, it's my opinion that a lot of these countries are not stupid. If America is going to accept illegal immigrants, they're going to empty their prisons. They're going to empty their mental institutions, their asylums, and they'll probably help get them to the border. And I live in Northwest Phoenix metro area. We see people that are begging on the corners, and frankly, with them, it's you don't know who they are. You know, you don't know, are they mentally ill and they can't get assistance, or they don't know to get assistance? Are they illegal, or are they pulling a scam? You know, that they've got their Chevy Tahoe around the corner and this is their form of labor instead of a regular job. But I think it's worse now than even back in the 70s and the 60s. You had the SDS and the Weathermen that were terrorist groups back then. You don't really have that, at least to this extent. So far, we don't have that. But what you have is the massive illegal immigration and the problems that comes with it, and a government that is shown a willingness to accept that.
Yeah, and let's get a little deeper into that. You know, you have, I think RFK Jr. and others have reported down at the border that it's not just illegal immigrants coming. It's a lot of people from the Middle East. It's potential, terrorist organizations crossing the border unfettered. You also, when you're talking about the border situation, you have all these groups that support it, and they take them from the border, and then, as you mentioned, they're exporting them throughout the country. What impact is illegal immigrants having throughout these cities right now? A lot of people say, hey, they're giving cheap workforce, and these are hungry people looking for a job, and they're coming in and they're starting families. They should be given a chance like any other immigrant. But how is that affecting major cities, and what's your take on the immigration situation in all the U.S. cities right now?
Well, I think from my perspective is that it's soaking up resources that should go to American citizens. You know, I think our society has an obligation to help those that are unable to help themselves, whether they're physically incapable or mentally incapable to do that. But you run out of money when, like, New York is paying $10,000 in cash cards every 4 weeks to every adult illegal immigrant. That's $130,000 a year just for breaking the law of being here. That's not a requirement to work or anything else. Well, just think what $130,000 could do to somebody that is mentally ill or homeless through no fault of their own, that is an American citizen, or a veteran that has simply been unable to readjust back to civilian living. And so what we're seeing is these resources are going to people who, quite frankly, don't have a legal right to them because they're not here through legal means. They have not legally immigrated.
There's reports now that illegal immigrants are allowed to carry weapons. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there was a court decision that came through, I believe, yesterday. A federal district court judge ruled that the Second Amendment under the Bruin Supreme Court order decision said that they are allowed to purchase and carry weapons. And I'm against that. First of all, they broke the law to get here. And the idea of the privilege of owning a weapon is that you are a law-abiding citizen. And they've already proven by their actions that they're not. So I'm going to be interested to see what the full circuit does on appeal. But you're looking at for the next year, probably that's going to occur unless her order is stayed. So but it's going to force law-abiding citizens will start doing the same thing. And in 29 states, open carry now is allowed, by state law.
And Biden has said if undocumented immigrants should not be turned over to immigration officials, the ones that are arrested by local police. You know, given that the border is wide open, what should happen? I mean, I guess local police, by and large, probably aren't arresting illegal immigrants, certainly not for violations of immigration status, but for others. What's the status of that? First of all, what should they do if they're arrested for crimes and or just illegal status? If you turn them over to the federal government, what happens to them? If a local official can't deport an illegal immigrant, this sounds like a mess. What exactly is the protocol? Say the illegal immigrant commits a violent crime. What happens?
Well, if they commit a violent crime, they fall under the state laws. So they'll be arrested, booked in. Eventually, they'll go to trial or maybe they'll plead. And then they'll be sentenced to prison. And if they're found guilty. And so they are treated no different than an American citizen is treated. The problem lies in that if they weren't here, it never would have happened. And so it's a crime that occurred that didn't have to. In my own neighborhood, two blocks over, an illegal immigrant driving a car with no license, no insurance, actually managed to hit two houses, and did probably six figures worth of damage to the two houses. And other than writing traffic tickets, the cops weren't able to do anything else. The citizens took off. They're probably in California now, or in New York, and they're gone. And the homeowner and their insurance company had to make them whole again. And so these are the things that occur that shouldn't occur if the border was regulated and people were allowed to immigrate according to the laws on the books. And if the laws are incorrect, then Congress needs to change them.
All right. I think my final question is, we're seeing, you know, the chaos in the cities. A lot of people are worried this is almost by design. And now you have, I think, New York City mayor bringing in federal troops, or maybe it's the governor, bringing in at least the National Guard to guard the subway, to guard parts of the city. Is this a federalization of law enforcement? Is this part of the design to make it so local communities have no control? And is that a bad thing? Should we be worried about that, having a federalized national police force, if that ends up that way?
Well, there's a federalized police force now, and that's the FBI. And so, you know, there's a lot of discussion that really they have lost their own track. I would be against the federalization of law enforcement. The cities have the best control. Bringing the National Guard in, first of all, the National Guard are not trained in law enforcement. The average National Guard, guardsman or guardswoman, are not trained for that. What they're trained to do is to take ground and to defend this country. And checking bags in a subway is not their training. And so I think it's a recipe for disaster, frankly.
All right. Well, thank you. We're out of time. Rick Alsham, retired police chief, thank you for your time on this. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. See you tomorrow. See you next hour. Mark.